myself.
All right, Commissioner, we're ready to roll. Commissioner?
Okay, all right, thank you, Darrell. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for coming here today. This is Commissioner Brian Culk. We're meeting for a, I'll call it a day-long planned discussion about 111D. And we, as for those of you who are just in the room, you've heard us back and forth a little bit about how we're going to run this thing today. Is it, when we initially talked about it, the three of us, Randy and Julie and I, basically, we wanted to hear from the investor owns that we have a direct role in regulating about what their thoughts were on 111D. And so we set up a block for MDU and then Otter Tail and Excel. And then, where's Mark Nisbet at? He's right. The ringleader here. All right. And Mark talked to me last week after the Empower meeting, and he said, you know, really, Brian, everybody's going to show up at 9 o'clock anyway. So that's, he said, are you okay with that? And I said, that's certainly fine. And along the way, we asked that our big G&Ts, we wanted to hear what they had to say. You know, of course, Basin, Minn Kota, and Great River. And I know, I believe they're out in the audience as well today. And Dave Glott, Dave has, I think, probably the pivotal role in this whole thing to develop a plan, perhaps, for the state. And Dave and I had a chance to talk briefly, and Dave, when we go around the horn, maybe I'd, if you want to, if there's anything particular you want to talk to the group about, I think that'd be great, because I guess what I, this is speaking just for me, the way I see this thing laying out is when these rules first came out, I was probably one of the ones that said, well, hey, these don't look that bad for North Dakota, and then I was quickly corrected and saying, hey, Brian, don't forget, these are proposed rules, okay, so I think in that lies the biggest challenge in this. These are proposed rules, so it's really hard for anyone to say these are good or bad because they're proposed. And so I spent a lot of time with my colleagues around the country, Republicans and Democrats, talking about what their states might be doing. Dave took the lead in having a symposium here a while back of getting a bunch of states together about what this might mean for a regional plan. And so there's a lot of stuff going on. But I guess the way I see this playing out is that the commission, the three of us, will file our comments with the EPA. We'll share those with everyone. Once these rules become final, roughly a little less than a year from now, litigation will drop all over the country. And North Dakota, I don't speak for the Attorney General, but North Dakota will have a decision to make on what they want to do. In the meantime, Mr. Glott and others will have the clock still be ticking on what they have to do. And in the meantime, all of you will be trying to figure out what generation you're supposed to build, not knowing what the rules are going to be. And so I think that's, from my viewpoint, the stage that we're in. So the goal that I was hoping for today is just to try to get a feel for where each company might be at, and if there's something that we've missed on, is, you know, the, I'm sure MDU is going to give us some details, something that we've missed, and, you know, all, like trying to increase the output of the power plants, they've got some numbers that just don't make sense. But if there's something that we've missed, highlighted, or something unique about the companies. I mean, I you know, Excel, in my viewpoint, has a much different spread and concern than maybe Otter Tail does. But they both serve two states, or at least two states. MDU, even more challenges, perhaps. The G&Ts, I mean, trying to figure out where everybody's at and how, if the rules slide one way, what that could mean to the company. If they slide back the other way, what that could mean to the company. The concern I do have from different states, I don't like the way it's set up now where states are really pitted against each other, where in these proposed rules, you know, South Dakota got hit pretty hard, I would think, from my viewpoint. Minnesota, you know, they got hit pretty hard too, but there's some in Minnesota that don't think it's hard enough. And so you've got those dynamics taking place. So my fear is the proposed rules look a lot different than these, I'm sorry, the final rules look a lot different than these proposed rules. So the thought today, I guess, is that we noticed it for everybody at once, so if we get ahead of schedule or behind schedule, that's certainly fine. But I think I've yammered enough. Maybe I'll turn it over to my colleagues if they want to fill anything out. And then, Dave, if you don't mind just giving us maybe what you'd like to get out of this meeting today, and then I think MDU's on the dot. We'll turn it back over to you guys. So, Randy, do you have any?
Well, I do. I think it from the time we started discussing having this day, I've continued to think almost daily that it's becoming increasingly important that we get this feedback and evaluation of where the people that are actually out working in the industry see how you all see it impacting your companies and your customers, and your evaluation of the proposed rules. I think that because of the importance of the health department ultimately writing any SIP that we would come up with, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Fedorchak, I think it would be nice if Dave Glott were just kind of given a little extra latitude to jump in with questions,
too. Yeah, I tried inviting him to the table, but he didn't want to come up here.
If there's something we're missing on the impacts to the companies or the customers, it's important that it get asked. And Dave's really a good expert in all this.
Come on, Dave.
You mentioned, Mr. Chairman, the fact that some have concluded that this doesn't really impact North Dakota maybe quite as badly as some of the other states and as what some of us expected that it might. And I really, really am nervous about anyone with that kind of an attitude. I think, you know, the president, before becoming president, proclaimed his opinions on coal. And however this would impact us now is probably not how it will impact us in years to come. I also would point out, I'm told that as an example of how this could play out, with the cross-state air pollution rule sometime back down in Texas, someone concluded that it didn't impact them just too badly, and so they either didn't file comments to the extent that they might have had they known what was going to happen, or they didn't comment at all. I'm not sure which was the case. Then after the comment period was up, the EPA changed the proposal and the rule, and then it did affect them much more adversely than what they had previously thought, but they weren't allowed to comment because the comment period was over. So I think we want to be very cautious about not falling into that trap, even though, and now I point out, I'm going to read something from the internet, so it's under that philosophy that it must be true if it's on there, right? But, you know, you wonder how big of a deal this can be. This is attributed to Charles McConnell, who we had here earlier in the year, and he is from Rice University. He says that the EPA 111D, if fully implemented, this would be the climate change result, 1% reduction in global CO2 output for the period up until 2030, which would result in 1/100th degree Celsius impact to global temperature, which would have the impact of lessening of global sea rise by an amount equal to 1/3 the thickness of a dime. So quite a shockingly small impact on climate change. And yet I point out also that Australia has just eliminated some of their environmental laws, and their Prime Minister Tony Abbott talked about in removing the burden on the Australian people. He called the electricity tax they had a $9 billion handbrake on the economy and a $550 a year hit on household budgets. So the impact on the customers is profound. The impact on the environment is almost non-existent, and the impact on North Dakota is pretty much unknown because we don't know if the proposed rules are even going to be close to the ultimate rules. So you just wonder where to even start in all this. So I'm glad we have a lot of experts in the room to hopefully by the end of the day have this picture clarified for us, and there'll be no more doubt, and we'll know exactly what our next move should be.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, Randy laid out all the confusion that exists and probably expressed it better than I can, so I won't go down that same path other than to say I echo some of his concerns on the ultimate goals of this rule and the long-term impact and benefits that it might have for our globe. But that being said, we have this rule to deal with, and so I think that we're going about it the best way we could, bringing all the experts, the folks that are on the front lines, delivering this electricity, and talk to you guys about what are your concerns, how do we make this work, what do we advocate for. I think there's two issues as I see it, and I'm hoping to get educated from you today. One is, what do we say about the proposed rules, And then what do we advocate to the EPA for in the final rules? And I think those are slightly different. I think we need to take the opportunity in our comments to the EPA, and I'll be working with my colleagues on this, to say, here's what we need. Here's what we don't like. Here's what doesn't work. Here's what concerns us. And here's what we need the final rule to look like. So I'll be looking for direction from you guys on that question. And then the other issue that we all can work on together is a piece that is really important, and I think is that is looking long-term for ways to continually educate the public. I've expressed to the EPA that, you know, they are going to be three layers or four layers removed from the effects of this proposal. It's going to be people like Dave Glott and people like us commissioners who are ultimately going to be saying, here's what customers pay. You guys will propose it. We'll have to approve it. And so I think in that lies the responsibility to educate people on what they're getting in return. And so if you guys have some thoughts, ideas on how we can continually educate the public about this issue in a very straightforward, I don't mean political, I don't mean, you know, throwing threatening phrases or, you know, exaggerations or anything, but just straightforward, here are the facts type of material, I'm really, I think we all need to look for ways to do that. So thanks again to Dave and his colleague, Tom, is it? Tom, for joining us. I do hope you join us up at the table and ask questions as part of the conversance in this dialogue. And I look forward to a productive morning. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Julie. Perfect segue. Mr. Glott, Dave, you and Tom want to give us your thoughts? We left a whole side for you, Dave. It's not as easy to slip out now, is it?
Well, first of all,
you have to press this button until it turns green.
You're assuming I want to be heard. Right?
Thank you. First of all, thank you for the invitation. We do think this is a very important rule. I cringe every time I hear that it's Dave Glott's going to be carrying the banner on. It just makes us a good target. But when it first came out, we were like a lot of people, like, this isn't what we expected. This is something that this may be doable. As time goes on, though, there's become more and more questions that really make it difficult for us to even start talking about a plan. What would a plan look like? There is just so much confusion out there. Questions like, what is the final goal? I am with Commissioner Chrisman on this, is that at the end of the day, 2030, I'm convinced that there'll be the comment, well, CO2 concentrations didn't go down. Now what? So if we go through all this pain and agony along the way, we don't see an environmental benefit, what did we do this for? That is the questions we have. Sitting with some other states, the questions such as how are renewables accounted for? We may have 20% in the state, but we may not be able to take credit for all of that. Is it somebody who buys it from Florida? If they buy the power from those wind towers, do they get credit for it down in Florida? We don't know that, and EPA isn't letting us know how that's going to be accounted for. That is huge for us to determine whether or not we can come in compliance with the goal. Issues such as demand side. You know, more we look into it, you know, you look at efficiencies of the power plants. They identified that as one of the four goals, the demand side. Quite frankly, I don't know how we're going to be able to account for that. So that may be just off the table and we're not looking at that. Basically, what leaves it then is renewables are going to be key to us as we move forward. The regional, I will tell you, I've talked to some companies and they started out talking inside the fence line and they went to regional. And we had folks talking regional going inside the fence line. So it tells me that the industry is struggling with this too as they start looking at all their assets, not only in North Dakota but also in other states. Looking at, well, maybe North Dakota got a pretty good deal on the goal. Can we use that to help us with our assets in other states? I am okay with that, but that just adds that other complexity onto that, looking at how that is all going to be dealt with. How is it federally enforceable? If on a regional plan we've asked these questions of EPA, if North Dakota pulls its weight, but a state that we have a part of the regional plan doesn't, who gets penalized? Is it everybody in the plan? Is it the state that doesn't pull their own weight? How do we enforce that into another state? I don't know. Mass and rate, there's discussions on that going back. And then the burden. Quite frankly, this proposed rule is different from anything else we've had to deal with. In the past, it's how much SO2, how much visibility we're impacting, and that's been pretty much a decision by the health department. You know, the PSC has been involved, but now this throws the PSC right in the middle. Because the states are asking, if we do all this work and do all the plans, and the PSC comes up and said, yeah, nice work, but we're not going with it because it affects affordability and reliability of the system for our customers. We're not going down that path. Where does that leave us? So there are a lot of questions in conference calls with the states and with EPA. I hear a lot from EPA. Good question. We'll get back to you. My sense of this whole deal is that from the state health department perspective, we're kind of, I wouldn't say standing on the sidelines, but we're not walking in the middle of the road either. We're waiting to see how this transpires. I don't think we can put a lot of effort into putting a plan together when we just don't know what the rules of the game are going to be. My overall sense is, and the states have asked this, is that, well, you'll come out with the final plan, the final rules, the attorneys will mobilize, they'll go through litigation, and then at some point when that's all done, can the clock start then? Because we may start putting all the plan together and we find out in litigation the rules of the games have changed and then we've wasted all that time and effort. So we don't know what the it is that we're trying to achieve. What you'll hear from the health department is that maybe we're going to, I hate to say this, is we're going to be EPA-like, and I will deny it if anybody says that we're like EPA. That it is, we got to sit back and really analyze where we're going to go with this. And I keep hearing from EPA that there's ultimate flexibility. I say BS because I just don't see that happening in anything they've done. And with the litigation, with the environmental groups getting involved, we want to do the right thing. We want to do something that actually shows an improvement to the environment. But we don't want to do a lot of frivolous activities that spend a lot of money to take away from those activities that we can see improvement in the environment. And this is the one that really is going to be difficult for us. So with that, I gave you a non-answer in a very long period of time. So.
All right. Thank you, Dave. All right, anything else, anybody, before we turn it over to MDU? Mike, Jerry, you guys got anything? Okay, Julie's got a sign-in sheet going around so we can see who's all here. Well, Abby, your name is on the presentation, so I don't know if I turn it over to you now or what. Jay's saying yeah,
yep.
So.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if we need to make introductions across or.
Why not?
If I can. Okay.
Just for the people who might be listening.
I'm Abby Krebsbach with Montana Dakota Utilities, and I'm our Director of Environmental.
Jay Scable with Montana Dakota, Vice President of Electric Supply.
Garrett Sanger with Montana Dakota and Vice President of Regulatory Affairs.
Larry Oswald with Montana Dakota, Manager of Business Development, Marketing, and Energy Programs.
Well, thank you, Chairman Kalk and Commissioners. We appreciate being invited here to speak about this, especially going first. I think I might be the longest. But I think Dave covered everything already. Okay. So let me make sure. Okay, great. Okay. Montana, Dakota owns a majority of its generation resources, and with the majority of those being coal-fired power plants. We also have purchase power, renewables, and gas-fired peaking units. We have about 125,000 retail customers on our integrated system, and we have a significant growth rate, especially for the next 5 years, with that growth expected to taper off a little bit in the future. Okay. Okay, now I got the direction going on the slides. Okay. Just to give you a little bit of status on our current generation fleet and a little bit of insight into maybe how these rules may impact, depending on the pollution controls that are required on those units from other rules coming up here. RM Heskett Station, we have a regional haze project to reduce SO2 that we'll be completing by 2016, and that actually has the effect of increasing CO2 emissions slightly due to limestone addition in that chemical reaction. Big Stone plant, Otter Tail is going to talk a lot about this. I'll just try to breeze through this. We have a regional haze project that is in that project. We tried to minimize any decrease in heat rate because of the additional significant pollution controls that will be added, like selective catalytic reduction for NOx controls. But we see challenges with heat rate improvements, and I'll talk about why that's important. Most of the heat rate improvements that EPA is proposing in this rule have been done at Big Stone, so we're wondering how that can be accomplished. EPA proposed some steep generation reductions in Building Block 2, which is the redispatch of coal to natural gas combined cycles. We'll talk about that. Lewis and Clark Station, for the mercury and air toxic standard rule, will be doing a co-fire of gas with coal, minimizing that co-fire as much as possible. But that has the effect of actually reducing some of our CO2 emissions there. With Coyote Station, we don't have any significant pollution controls that we would expect to be detrimental to the heat rate, but most of the major heat rate improvement projects have been done on that unit as well.
Abby, could you just, I know that we probably have this in some books somewhere, but do a quick, what the end of life at the Heskett Station is, what Big Stone, Coyote, what the generation you have, when do you think you're going to be able to run it until now, pending those CO2 rules?
Well, we don't have any plans to retire any of our units.
But there must be a planning figure, like Heskett's good to 2050.
We haven't established a remaining useful life date of any of our units, but that's something that comes up in the rule as a potential option to look at to ensure you're not incurring significant costs on units and you're taking the remaining useful life of the plant into effect. And so we haven't identified any dates. That would be a huge discussion that we would have to have with you folks. And
no, exactly, but that's the point, I guess. I'm trying just to get a feel for it. Like when we cite a wind farm, we say this wind project is probably going to be 25, 30 years. And so you got a start date that you kind of know is where either you're going to retire the asset or probably your maintenance is going to go up. I'm just trying to get a feel for it.
Yeah, there are
none of these plants are in the 20-year horizon as far as anything you're thinking of. I'm trying to put you in a box here.
Well, there's things we've been thinking about with the age of some of the plants and the smaller economies of scale with a couple of our plants that it could be a potential that they would be uneconomic in future due to other environmental regulations as well as this one.
That's got to be a huge thing in my mind about what we file for comments, that we want no premature retirement of any assets.
Yeah, we'll talk about Big Stone especially in regard to that in a little bit. But yes, you're right. Those are things that we're thinking about even more so with this rule. And because it's proposed, it makes it even more difficult.
Right.
We don't know what that final requirement will be.
And Abby, while we've got you interrupted, I want to bounce back and forth between this slide and the previous one where you had the megawatts of the categories of plants. So when you say own 553 megawatts of generation, 75%, that means that's 75% of you buy the other 25% off the market?
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
And then the 103 megawatts of gas turbines, is that counting?
That counts.
Like Heskett out here is already being done, or
nope, that doesn't include. Yeah, that just includes our peaking units out in Montana.
Okay.
At Glendive and Miles City. So once we add Heskett in there, by the end of this year,
okay,
it's commercially operational. That just hasn't been added in there yet. But that will decrease the amount of coal-fired capacity in our mix. Correct. But it's not a baseload resource, so.
And on the wind generation, that's not counting heading or thunder.
Correct. Right. That doesn't.
Right. And the up at Sydney, is that considering that still to be fully coal-fired or gas-fired in these numbers or what?
Correct. That include assuming Lewis and Clark is coal-fired in this, yeah.
Okay, so that'll be dropping that number some when that changes over to gas.
Yeah, possibly. We'll have to figure out how that gets added into that and averaged. Okay. Yeah.
Can you clarify the percentages again? What do those refer to?
The percentages are what our capacity mix are. So what our generation mix that provides capacity for our customers, electric capacity on, I believe it's our peaking. Yep, resource adequacy.
Thank you, Abby, for going first, because everybody else is saying, I'm glad it's you doing first.
Yeah.
Don't let them fool you.
Well, I brought a bunch of people up here to help answer the questions. Okay. Environmental, never thought we'd actually get into energy efficiency programs. Kind of. I don't know. So we do have wind generation as well in Montana and North Dakota. And just keep in mind that there is a little bit of Montana's, there's a share that goes from North Dakota wind that's used in a Montana RPS. And like I mentioned, we do have gas simple cycle peakers, of which I did add the Heskett Unit 3-1 here.
Abby, do you...
Hold on 1 second, Brian. Can we do like church and slide to the middle so we can make some room on the ends? There's a couple spare seats over there that we don't want Jason to have to stand all morning.
You guys can sit up topside too. That's fine. The Abby, the question for, I guess, any of you over there, but one of the frustrations that I have as a regulator is that I know the South Dakota guys and gals pretty good. I know the Minnesota guys and gals pretty good. I don't know anybody in Montana that to kind of get their thoughts. Who do you talk to over there? I mean, their commission, I've never really grown a relationship with them, and I don't know why exactly that is other than they kind of keep to themselves.
Yeah, that's...
You know, we have the same requirements in Montana as they do in North Dakota in regards to the IRP and... basically, who we talk there would be the commissioners themselves, you know, with Chairman Gallagher. He's the chairman of the commission. They have four other ones. And, again, I believe from an environmental aspect, Abby probably can refer maybe to the Montana DEQ and who you work with on that end.
So how do they, I guess, how do they see this at a 10,000-foot look without getting...
I think they, at this point, really haven't been maybe as... they have other things in front of them right now and aren't really addressing this. I think they will be as well and probably will the same format will employ in terms of workshops and summits and things like that as have been held in, you know, Wyoming, South Dakota, and now North Dakota.
Okay. I think part of it is, you know, we spend a lot of time with the other states because of transmission projects where we have nothing hardly at all in Montana, if we need anything. So, okay.
Abby, would you break that statement that Montana's share of North Dakota wind is used for Montana RPS down into what wind farm, or what percentages? And
I'm not exactly sure on the percentage off the top, but we have approximately 50 megawatts of wind total within for the Diamond Willow Wind Farm, which is on the Montana side, and then Cedar Hills, which is on the North Dakota side. Montana has a 15% renewable portfolio standard by 2015. Okay. And so I'm not exactly sure the percentage breakdown of how much that goes to the RPS, but there is a portion of the Cedar Hills wind farm that is utilized for that RPS requirement.
which would make it unavailable for North Dakota's.
Well, right now it certainly is in the state targets. The North Dakota wind is included in the North Dakota target. But depending on, Dave mentioned, there's some contradictory in statements that the EPA makes in the technical support documents and the rule that states that have an RPS could potentially claim the wind that was put in another state for the compliance with this rule. And then they say different things. And then they separate everything out by state and identified how the targets were set by assuming that the wind in the state is how that's created. I'll talk about that a little bit more to try to explain that, I guess. But that's we don't know where that's going. We just wanted to point that out because we see it as a potential issue that what if Montana claimed our percentage of Cedar Hills in their compliance plan, then that would leave it out of North Dakota's ability to use it for their compliance.
Well, and even if we meet our renewable requirements now, if we allowed that years later, most things get ratcheted down as the years go by. Like Dave said, we get to 2030, and there's been no significant impact on climate change, and so then our requirements grow, and then we've already allowed Montana to use some of our renewables and calculating the standards. So I don't know that that's agreeable.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of complexities with this. Okay. So you know, if I'm getting too much in the weeds here, let me know, and I will move on. Being first, I wanted to talk about everything. Okay. Obviously, the rule was proposed on June 2nd and in the Federal Register on the 18th. Comments are due on the 16th. We're focusing our comments on how EPA has proposed reductions in their kind of option one, scenario one. They do have alternate, a little bit lower emission standards in the rule proposed too, slightly lower. I'll focus on option one. So when you look at how EPA came up with this 30% CO2 mass reduction from the 2005 electric sector emissions, they basically first determined how can we get those reductions. And then they created a methodology of how they calculate how they get those reductions from four building blocks, which I'll talk about. And then after those calculations were done, they had a mass of emissions that were reduced. Then they went back and looked at, well, how much is this reduced from our 2005 emissions? And that's how the 30% came about. The 30% was not, hey, we think this is going to make a difference. It was actually developed from the calculations. So just to keep in mind that 30% reduction from 2005 emissions, when EPA did the calculations for the best system of emissions reduction in those building blocks, they used a baseline of 2012, which really effectively discounts some of the reductions that have been made before that time. And I think this speaks to Commissioner Christman's comments. I just did a calculation based on some IPCC past projections of CO2 from energy-related activities globally in 2030. We would, with the 733 million metric tons reduced, which is equivalent to that 30% reduction that EPA says, that's only about 2% or less than 2% of the projected emissions that will be in 2030. So it's pretty small. EPA has
of
said
the U.S.'s.
The 733, the 2% is the U.S.'s electric sector reduction to the total global projected in 2030.
So it will be an insignificant number of the world's.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you go through again? Because I've heard Gina McCarthy try to explain this herself, and I still don't understand the difference between the 2005 reduction. That's the baseline, and then but using 2012 numbers. Can you explain how that works again?
Okay. EPA didn't use the 2005 numbers except to kind of illustrate what that 733 million ton reduction is in terms of 2005 emissions.
Okay.
EPA used 2012 emission rates from our plants and assumptions of where we were at from renewables deployment, energy efficiency deployment, and what our combined cycles were operating at in 2012, and then made assumptions on how those operations and deployment would change based on current state RPSs that have been developed, what has actually been going on. They made assumptions based on what was being done and just projected that forward using 2012 emissions. So let's say we made heat rate improvements to our plants in 2005. Well, EPA uses our 2012 better emission rate at those plants to assume that we can make further reductions when we've already made those reductions.
So do you have to have a 30% drop in total mass from your 2012 numbers or 2005?
That's a good question for the state. The state has the target, and so utilities will be contributing something to achieve that target. And I'm not sure how you're thinking of doing that, Dave.
Back to your previous initial response.
Okay.
We don't know. Do you have any comment on that, Tom?
No, I guess the simplest way would be just for the state to develop a plan that gives each utility that state target.
Which would base it on which year, though?
Well, using EPA's current number, it would be which is based on 2012 data.
So it would be a 30% reduction on 2012 data?
No. The way EPA did this is they used two different years. 2012 was the baseline year to establish how the sources are operating and how the blocks were calculated. However, I believe there was a promise that we'd have a 30% reduction in CO2 from 2005 emissions. So basically, all that the EPA did was go back to 2005 and calculate how much of these rules would have an effect on 2005 emissions.
So the block of the massive reductions was calculated from that, and that'll be spread out around everybody starting at 2012 baseline. That's what you're saying. It would be the easiest way, possibly.
Yeah, 2012 was just the year they picked to start their calculations for the four blocks.
All right.
And that's one of the comments we hear nationally, too, is that there are some companies that did a lot of work prior to 2012. And they basically squeezed all the efficiencies out of the plant. Mm-hmm. Now they're asking to go back and check and see if their EPA is assuming 6%, which it may not be there. And so there are some utilities are saying, hey, we've already done our homework. We did our work, and now we're being penalized for that.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okay. If we were to... One concern with if we take that simple approach with applying the state target to our units in here, we would not be able to meet that limit at a coal-fired unit. And that's, again, kind of why EPA looked at these other kind of beyond-the-fence mechanisms of compliance. So it'll be challenging if that occurs.
Abby, when is you said MDU is going to file comments?
Yes.
Always. So can we get a copy of those? And when are you thinking that MDU might be sending those in?
Well, by the 16th.
Good answer.
Yeah, well, we'll be trying to develop them as soon as we can here.
That's one of the things that I'm hopeful that Otter Tail and everybody else will to excel, but if there's differences in what the investor owns want, which there probably will be, then we'll have to either be silent on it or weigh in. We think this is one way or the other. So if you could file them at least the 15th, that'd give us a day to still.
Yep. Yeah, we will do that. And I think you'll hear a lot.
And Vic has volunteered from our staff to be the lead on that.
Okay. I think you'll hear a lot of the similar points here, right, that will be comforting, that you'll be able to make some good comments on utilities. Okay, so just want some comments on the timeline itself. Here is a bar with years shown. So the rule is proposed. The rule is expected to be final June of next year. So you should see some individual state plans happening or going into EPA year after that. That's a challenge. With the complexity of this rule, that's a challenge. There might be an extension that can be requested. Then what's interesting is you have some, what I was able to see in the rule is you have some assumptions that EPA makes that energy efficiency programs in North Dakota even are actually being implemented in 2017 to help ramp up for the reductions further on into 2030. So you have these assumed reductions that are happening with these programs, and you don't even have a plan approved. I'm not sure if you can have legislation approved in that time or what. So. Then multi-state plans, if states plan to work together, would be in about mid-2017 with a possible extension for them as well. But then you have EPA approving the plans very quickly after that. And I guess one comment there is the regional haze program, which Dave had brought up. It's, you know, when you look at how long it took to get those first plans in place, submitted and approved, and this rule is expected to be more complex than that. The timeline just doesn't match. And then very shortly after EPA approves, we have to start demonstrating reductions because there are interim goals that the EPA provides. So EPA established both final and interim goals. I keep talking about the final 2030 goal. But there are actual goals, interim. The final goal for each state is to be met in 2030. EPA, you know, with the interim goals, states must demonstrate emissions performance from affected plants on an average basis over that 10-year period. And basically, that's just EPA making sure that things are happening before the deadline hits 2030. And again, I mentioned the regional haze concern with it taking multiple years. States just need more time to plan this out.
Abby, for you or anybody else, I guess, that wants to throw it out there, this is a great timeline, but there's a piece that I've been struggling with about the legal side of this. And so, you know, I think it's a classic states' rights versus federal rights. But so that gets filed, let's say, June of 2015. I got the question the other day about, do you think a judge will stay this? And I have no idea. But is there a time frame that we would know whether the judge would do, and where would this would get filed, or is it good all over the country? Is that somebody in the group must know that. Maybe for a later group, if you guys don't have that.
I don't know whether it be state or not. We have the same concern. We've thought about that, too, where if it wouldn't be state, the state would still have to march down the path of requiring reductions from us, and we'd have to start implementing things. If it was state, my guess is that it would take maybe a year for that to get heard, maybe more, 1 to 2 years. And I don't know. I think other people might have other attorneys might have other opinions on that. But.
Okay. Well, for the
so
next
that's a long time
you guys,
to march
I'm looking
down
at Stacy because I know she's an attorney too. But I mean, that's where, back to Dave's point in the beginning, I think that's just a critical decision point. If when the lawsuits get filed, if the judges say, well, that's fine, but then that's the pinch point right there. If the judge says, well, let's just wait a year, well, then all of a sudden a year drops out in the rules, and so I think that's a critical thing for all of us to get a feel for what that might be.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there clarity on what the energy efficiency programs are going to be because they have that coming ahead of the plans even being submitted?
No.
Is there none needed that it's just 1.5% a year? And
it's lower percentages in those early years, lower than 1.5% starting up. But EPA doesn't delegate the specific programs. It just assumes that probably more of the low-hanging fruit type programs are implemented. But I didn't see anything prescriptive in the rule.
And it's not like they need to approve the plans or anything like that. It's just expected that
we'll
come up with a plan that meets that whatever the target is for that year.
Yeah, that we will start motivating ourselves to get those reductions sooner, probably to spread costs out over time.
And when you measure that, you know, if you had two utilities in two different states and one is growing at 1% a year and the other is growing at 10% a year, how do you compare that as far as your energy efficiency compared to, because there's growth there too, so how do you measure that?
Yeah, because the energy efficiency assumptions are based on your sales. It would have to, well, depending on what the states would do and require, that is how the EPA has assumed it would work, that you would have to meet a certain percentage savings in electricity based on your sales. So as we grow, that also increases the amount of savings, which gets a little confusing because if we're growing, you could potentially have newer things being put in anyway, and you wouldn't have the savings reductions even though you have the growth.
And I know Abby will talk about this in a future slide. We'll show you some of our projections, but we used what our forecasted sales were, so that would take into account what our growth is. But most typically, you'd probably, you know, potentially a state plan would look at setting up a baseline year. Here's your 1.5% from that baseline year, you know, over a course of a period of years, and then reset that baseline based upon a three-year average or weather normalized, is what has happened in other states that have some conservation programs. So, but those details really aren't defined within the proposed rule at this point in time.
But if a company like MDU, if all of a sudden there's three or four gas processing plants that you didn't expect to occur that each take 50 megawatts, isn't that going to more than chew up any energy efficiency programs you've put in place and cause you to fail to have achieved it?
Well, because, okay, EPA set the targets as emission rates, and that was important for us, especially in North Dakota, because we are growing. You can utilize, I'll show you how the targets, maybe that would help if I got to that slide. And
I'll wait till you get to the right spot.
I guess I had a question. It goes back to federal enforceability of demand-side energy efficiency programs. Mm-hmm. My understanding is North Dakota does not have a standard in place. Do you think we need one to get this to be in federally enforceable?
I can speak for one of three commissioners that I don't like that idea. I mean, there's the pinch right there.
Yeah, it all comes down to federal enforceability and how we can establish that. And that's the question we have put to EPA, is how do we do that?
And the other question is, how do you do the accounting? Is it consistent across utilities? And how, if we find out we're not meeting a standard, what happens?
Yeah.
And so, you know, for us, it's like defaulting back to the goal. I don't know if it – I'll get myself in trouble, but at the end of the day, do you meet the goal, yes or no? Doesn't matter on the demand side, whatever else, efficiencies. If you can meet the goal, you meet the goal, and we would say, EPA, we're there, see ya. That would be the simplest. But then you get down into the weeds, and how do you do the accounting on each of that, and that's something that's going to be difficult as we sit here today.
Yeah, I think states have the ability to utilize the blocks in any way they wish. EPA just proposed this methodology and these reductions, which create the 30% total reduction. And so if states don't want to make those federally enforceable, well, I think they have to be federally enforceable in order to utilize them for any compliance. Yeah, it just has to be.
So you need the legislation?
Maybe or maybe not.
I'll show you how that breaks down too, and how maybe, we can think about the enormity of that block versus the other ones, or lack of enormity, or depending on the state. Okay, so Here are the building blocks. You've probably heard all about them. Building block one, heat rate improvements are expected at existing coal-fired power plants, with the proposed requirement being an average 6% improvement based on our 2012 emission rates at our plants. Block two is the redispatch of coal units to natural gas combined cycles, either existing or having been under construction prior to January 8th, 2014. So they're not new units that EPA assumes reductions come from. So EPA assumes that all combined cycles within that block, all combined cycles across the U.S., would run at a 70% capacity factor based on their 2012 capacities. So what if they're running at 40%, then they're going to run up to 70%, and then coal's going to back off proportionately. So if it's, yeah, okay. So with number three, renewable energy deployment, EPA assumes certain percentages of RPS wouldn't be implemented across states depending on the regions, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on that. For North Dakota, it's 15%, and for our Montana and Wyoming areas, it's 21%. And the percentages are based on the way in which EPA broke up the states regionally and looked at all the RPSs that existed from states in those regions and just averaged that and then applied it to every state. So you would have to put on new, or state wouldn't have to ensure that renewables were employed based on a percentage of the total electric generation in the state, which includes renewables as well, which we don't think that that might be appropriate, because if you're looking at reductions from coal, you should be looking at just the fossil units. But right now, the way the EPA calculated is it's based on all fossil and then renewable as well as added in there. Block four is the energy efficiency demand side reduction programs, and that's a 1.5% annual incremental savings over time up to 2030. Okay.
Abby, at what point will you be able to put a cost to this?
We will put a cost in this presentation to at least one of those issues.
Say that again.
One of the blocks creates such an impact to us in South Dakota,
yeah,
that we put a cost together. So we'll share that. But some of the other...
And I understand that it's going to have some variability, but it's the question that we get is, okay, well, what's this going to cost? And for back in the cap and trade days, I said, well, it's, you know, depending who you are, it'd be anywhere from a 30 to 60% increase in cost. And people be like, whoa, so it's... It'd be nice to just somehow just get some range that this could cost the average consumer. Because ultimately, that back to one, I think, Commissioner Crispin's comments early about what's this cost impact to customers and business and all those things.
Yeah.
I mean, would this be a more or less than a cap and trade type of cost to MDU? Hard to tell once again,
yeah,
right?
It's, yeah, hard. Well, if it's causing the replacement generation occur, that's too costly. And I'll talk about that a little bit with, okay, potential there.
Okay. On building block number two, that's just the combined cycle plants.
Correct. Not peaking units. Just natural gas combined cycles.
And what do you have for combined cycles?
We don't have any.
So what do you do with that?
Well, I'll talk about it a little bit, but basically, if there are no combined cycles in a state, so when EPA set the state targets, they looked at what was in each state. If there isn't a combined cycle in that state, that there are no reductions required from that block. And that North Dakota doesn't have any, so there are none, no emissions reductions for that.
Is that why South Dakota got hit so hard?
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yep. And then Montana doesn't either, so those two states didn't have reductions for that. But yeah, Minnesota and South Dakota had that block as significant.
And Miles City and Glendive are also peakers.
They're peakers, yes. Okay.
Oh, so, yeah. If you completely transition Sydney to gas, would that be, that's not combined cycle?
No,
That will be considered a peaker?
Yeah.
Even though you're going to plan on running it,
yeah,
as baseload, right?
Well, that unit, if we converted it 100% to gas, we really think that that would run very much just due to the cost difference between the coal It's a very affordable resource for us there. If we converted to gas, the costs would be high. That's why with our co-fire, we're trying to minimize, and we expect that to be, you know, smaller percentage of what we would burn there. But, yeah, we have not ever proposed a total co-fire, 100% co-fire as an option. It is too costly there. Although you would gain a lot of CO2 reductions.
Abby, I have a question if you know. On the wind generation, it says 15% of North Dakota totals. Is that year in 2012, at the end of the year of 2012? Or?
It starts ramping in... North Dakota's sitting pretty well there because there's a lot of wind.
Increases right. In 2012.
There aren't because there's a lot of wind already. EPA applies a formula of an expected percentage increase in those interim years that I showed you from 2020 to 2029. North Dakota doesn't have any increase until really the very end, just based on how much wind is already in the state. It's applied to the target.
But if we're going to let other states count that, then...
Yeah, that's a concern. And we've done kind of some back of the envelope calculations on that because we don't know how much wind would go anywhere else. But if you did a recalc, some argue that if that occurred, we'd have to recalculate the targets so that we'd have a correct target. Although some of the impacts of that, it doesn't change the target all that much, and it depends on how much wind really. Is we did a kind of like a 50% wind was going somewhere else. The targets wouldn't change that significantly for those states, but we would have a significant amount of renewable that we would have to make up because megawatt hours that we would have to deploy because that wouldn't be there anymore. So with like a, I just calculated a, you know, anybody else is sub, you know, you can do your own calculations. So I'm putting a disclaimer in there, but, like if you did 50% wind to another state, the amount of megawatt hours you would have an increase in would be equivalent to like an 800 megawatt size wind farm. I did, assuming like 34% capacity. Whereas right now in my next slide, I show a really small amount that North Dakota has to provide, and it ends up being around a 60 megawatt size wind farm that we have to come up with amongst our generating utilities in the state. So, yeah, it changes the what we would have to deploy for renewables significantly. And then when you start doing that, you have, well, I'll talk about those concerns in my next slides.
Is there something in the rules, the proposed rules, that suggests that they're going to do that? Or that there's because I thought that just by virtue of being a tool of regulation using the Clean Air Act, you had to keep the sources of generation in each state and calculate everything per that state. So what this assigning to other states, some of the wind that they're paying for, where in the proposed rules is that?
There's comments on that in the state. I don't have it with me here. The state proposed goals. It's a technical support document that talks about that. And I can't remember the name of it off. There are a lot of technical support documents for this role, but it's the one talking about state goal considerations, I believe.
And so what
EPA does there is it leaves open the door that some states may want to claim that, but doesn't really identify how that can be done. And again, they created the targets in a way that'll seem to allow the state that has a generation in it to claim it. So EPA has to clarify that in the final rule.
Do they then allow for assigning the CO2 emissions to the state that uses the power?
A lot of people are talking about that. If you take, yep.
I mean, it has to be either share.
Yep, you have to take the coal megawatts.
Renewables
as well as
the CO2 has to get assigned to where it's used, or they both have to be assigned to where it's produced, I would think.
Yeah. That's significantly changing their methodology and how they calculated the targets that I don't know how they could do that in just a final rule without really reproposing a significant reproposal.
We've talked about that, too, as far as where that goes. And we mentioned that, well, if you take the wind, you take the CO2. But then who controls that plant then? Is it, can Minnesota dictate what a power plant does in North Dakota because they have the CO2 emissions? It really gets ugly fast. And I've also heard heat rate improvements. We asked the question, the efficiencies, do they stay with the plant? And that door is left open, that another state could take credit for that. And so that just, the more non-answers we get, the more confusing it gets as we move forward. And that's the difficult part.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, these are the targets that are assigned to the states in which I was thinking that would get talked about today. Of course, the North Dakota, Montana, South Dakota targets are most important for MDU. North Dakota and Montana are fairly similar in their interim and final targets. However, you see that much higher 21% reduction in Montana, and that's really based on the higher percent renewable in Block 3 that Montana is subject to because of the Western States region having a much higher RPS average. South Dakota is really impacted by Block 2, and I'll talk about that. Minnesota has some Block 2 issues, too, and I'm going to let those utilities from Minnesota talk about that. But they have a pretty stringent target as well. Okay. And I took one of the ways in which it's kind of helped me think about this rule is to look at it in terms of, okay, how many megawatt hours reduction does EPA calculate or can be calculated from each of the blocks that we would have to either reduce our coal plants at to gain the emissions reductions. So I did that for each of the blocks, and it just serves to kind of identify where the issues are again. So like North Dakota, you have about 1.7 million megawatt hour reduction. Like if we couldn't get our 6% efficiency improvements from our plants and we had the other blocks to look at, you know, how much wind does that equal? I'm just kind of thinking about that off the top. So you have North Dakota and Montana, and again, that they're about in the same. The reductions from Block 1 are all across the board in those states, and it's just based on the coal-fired plant generation in each state. South Dakota's is small there because there's really only one coal-fired unit, and that's our co-owned Big Stone plant. Block 2 reductions, you can see where, since there's no combined cycles in that state, there's no reductions in Block 2, but they're significant for Minnesota and South Dakota. South Dakota, our main issue there is that redispatch of Big Stone to the one combined cycle in that state, which is Deer Creek, which was under construction in 2012. And there's a huge redispatch assumption associated with that. In Block 3, North Dakota, again, I just back the envelope, that 180,000 megawatt hours. That's about equivalent to about a 60 megawatt wind farm size.
You anticipated my question. I was like, how many hours divided by whatever?
Yeah. I didn't do that for the rest. But but yeah, what I wanted to show is that South Dakota and Minnesota, EPA actually, because how much wind they have in those states or renewables, that they actually have a surplus. So those negative numbers indicate megawatt hours that they have that they don't have to use for compliance, that if they wanted to, they could use them in other ways. Block 4 energy efficiency, those numbers are just based on the megawatt hour reduction on an annual basis needed to comply in 2030 with what sales we have or what sales EPA had projected for each state. With Minnesota, of course, being the largest because of the population base there.
Let me just ask the standard what-if question. So if Big Stone can't run as much as we plan on it running and the gas plant runs, then MDU comes back here for a rate increase instantaneously, correct?
Well,
the answer's got to be yes.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a cost that you can figure.
Yeah, we did that. I'll get there. I'm sorry it's taking me so long.
But I'm trying to think about comments that we have. That's a direct impact to North Dakota ratepayers.
Yes, absolutely.
It's in South Dakota jurisdiction, North Dakota ratepayers, because we've got a huge chunk of that assigned to our rate base.
Yes.
And that cost is going to go from, what, 7 cents to 12 to 18 cents or whatever. Who knows,
yeah,
but it'll
be more.
About
a 10% rate increase just from that. I'll talk about that a little bit and show you how we calculated that.
Plus, customers would still be paying for the upgrades at that plant.
Correct. Correct.
Yep.
Yeah.
On top of the upgrade.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't know who it was attributed to, but it came from the South Dakota PUC meeting that this would require Big Stone to be shut down for about half the year, at which point it doesn't pay to have it running the other half. So
23% capacity factor assumption based on the dispatch, redispatch.
23% capacity factor assumption. That it could run 23% of the time?
Yep. Well, yeah, under EPA's assumptions that that's possible to actually redispatch to
and a so different unit. If you were to do that, that would, I suppose you would start it for a little bit in July and August and a little bit in the coldest part of the winter. And
it's what we've determined is you wouldn't do that. It would be infeasible, and you'd have to replace it with combined cycle of equivalent or comparable size.
So we're not really talking about tapering back Big Stone. We're talking about mothballing it.
That's what the effect of this block and how EPA did its methodology and calculations for South Dakota. That is the impact. Yes.
Did they, in their calculations, assume, I thought I was told that they assumed that that would be redispatched to the basin unit? So that somehow you guys could get all your power from the basin unit. Is that true? Or was that...
Well, that's their assumption that if you have the combined cycles in the same state, that that is possible to occur, yes.
Okay.
When you talk about that with EPA, one of their statements is, well, you can work with other states to get that to happen. Work together. But EPA has heard this a number of times from us now. Number of different, we've talked in Denver, they were at the PUC meeting in South Dakota, they've been at industry meetings, and they've specifically heard this issue, and they know it's an issue, and they're thinking about it. We need to make comment. And it'd be great if the Public Service Commission here made comment, too.
But it's almost like there will be no scenario that you could have a states-only North Dakota plan because of this type of scenario. Because the impact to customers would happen no matter how you slice it.
Well, if EPA actually corrected that target, which we'll talk about, if they corrected it, it makes it more feasible for us to. It makes it more feasible for states to potentially work individually. But we like that we could utilize a fleet-wide approach to compliance, but we know that that's pretty complicated. More to follow here. Okay, so just wanted to let you look at our fleet-wide emissions reductions. So our pounds per CO2 emissions per net megawatt hour rate over time. We've decreased our emission rate by about 12.5% in the 2012 to 2013 timeframe when compared with 2005 emission rate. And that with our additional wind project that we expect to come online 2016-2017, that brings us further down to about reducing our emission rate by about 20%. Keep in mind that the individual state rates for like Montana and North Dakota are in the 1770-1780 range, so we're still above that. When you look at just our fleet, coal-fired and gas and wind, so all of that is added in here to create this emission rate. We add in our wind that we own, renewables, everything. That's what our emission rate is. And then if you look at just our North Dakota fleet.
One more second on that, Abby. Is that largely from, what is that from?
A lot of that's from our renewables. Deployment, we have our Ormat waste heat recovery project we implemented too. That helps that. But mostly from wind, and we've done heat rate efficiency improvements at our plants that factor in there too. The majority is from that.
Wind
and, yeah, mostly from wind. And you see that same reflected here in our North Dakota fleet rate. And we approach that 1949 pound per CO2 per net megawatt hour rate with Thunder Spirit, our wind project coming online later. So we're getting there if North Dakota was looking at this individually. But that doesn't necessarily help the rest of our fleet. So just to mention, EPA did want comment on other compliance options that could be maybe considered best system of emission reduction or utilized for compliance. We don't think that any of these should be used for best system of emission reduction. We think that they could leave it open for states to utilize these options for further compliance. That's, you know, conversions to natural gas. There were no requirements in the building blocks on this, but we would like to be able to use it. Carbon capture and storage, new combined cycle generation, that's really helpful in states where you have your emission rate target above 1,100 pounds per megawatt hour. If it's below it, because combined cycles operate at about that emission rate, if your target's lower, you don't want to add those into the target because they'll just effectively make it tougher for you to achieve the target. But for North Dakota, Montana, that would be potentially helpful.
So right now, if a large combined cycle were built in North Dakota, it just doesn't get factored in? Or how does it not lower
They're subject
average?
To the new source, greenhouse gas NSPS, but EPA seems to leave open the door within this rule that you could utilize them also for compliance with the existing source NSPS. And I'm not sure if any attorneys have opinions on that, but I'm not sure how that's going to work. But hey, if they're offering it, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, this is just cleaning up. Ask another question. With your wind purchase from Thunder Spirit, if that had been a bigger purchase, would that have helped you better?
Yes, because, well, interesting. We think it would, because it would serve to reduce our fleet pounds per megawatt hour. But what's interesting is when you add more renewables into the system, and we don't have necessarily a formula for figuring this out yet, but as you add more of the renewables on, your coal-fired plants back off load. Coal-fired plants were designed to achieve their most efficient heat rates at max load. So once you start backing those off, it creates issues with block one, with trying to meet those targets for block one. But so there's some interconnectedness issues that it seems like EPA did not consider.
So in your case, it's a function of what happens in the oil field for whether you could use the additional energy or not for purchasing more wind.
Oh, well, yeah. Since we are growing, you potentially could be adding more wind and not having to curtail your coal plants. I'm not sure if I understand your question.
My direct question, maybe I've been going around in circles too much, is that Thunder Spirit project was 150 megawatts and you only bought 107 of it. If you'd have bought the whole 150, would that have been better?
I'm not sure about the cost increase, how that played into the IRP process.
You're talking strictly about compliance with the CO2 emissions. Yeah. And as Abby said, you know, theoretically, at first blush, yeah, probably the more wind you would add, the better off you'd be. But that has the effect of ramping down your coal plants, which has the effect of making your coal plant efficiency worse, which makes your compliance with that building block one worse. And we haven't calculated whether they balance out. I would say probably you'd be better off the more wind you added, but possibly not.
For compliance with CO2 would not necessarily rates the impact to customers.
Correct.
You reminded me of something, though. And it speaks to how we're making decisions now based on, you know, what rules are in place at this time. But look what's going to happen as this rule gets finalized and we start trying to develop IRPs and plan for future. There's so many different complexities that come into play, and maybe we would be buying more wind. But at this point, that rule isn't final, and we're not sure how that's going to work. And we're, you know, we have to go by our past IRP process for that decision. Okay.
Well, let me just say it seems like a pretty sad day for America's economy. I don't see a bright future if our utility companies are buying generation that they don't need just to meet these kinds of standards. Heaven help us if that's the case.
Okay. I just wanted to touch on block one again. These are the EPA-assumed equipment improvements and O&M improvements that plants should do to gain that total 6% average reduction. EPA used the SNL, Sargent & Lundy report to develop these assumptions, and a lot of the plants have already done these projects. I'll talk about that a little bit more too. So, like I mentioned, for Big Stone and Coyote, a majority of these projects have been done. We're still evaluating Heskett and Lewis and Clark, although what we can preliminary say is we've done at least pieces and portions of them, if not total replacement or equipment improvements. So there are reductions we have seen at those plants, but we're further evaluating. Also, just to keep in mind, again, the regional haze issue with, you know, having to deploy additional pollution controls that are detrimental to the heat rate, whether it's auxiliary power needs or a reaction that actually results in CO2 emissions, although it doesn't necessarily affect the heat rate that much. So it'll be interesting to see how we try to measure that.
So you're not able to achieve any heat rate efficiencies here? So you can basically do zero?
We haven't come up with a number ourselves, but we're still looking at that. It's going to be tough to come up with a number. You know, actually, back of the envelope kind of stuff we did about 8 months ago, we thought potentially it might be in the range of maybe 1 to 2%, might be more doable, but we're still evaluating that.
Okay.
And every utility is going to have a different answer for that, depending on what they've already done at their facilities.
Mm-hmm. And you can't do anything under 2 either, so that's off the table, but so you're left with renewable and demand side.
Correct, yeah.
Do you have a slide in here that calculates how much renewable you'll need to purchase to meet this?
Not in here. But I have done a calculation of that. Yeah, I can dig it out.
And then the other question, the follow-up to that is it even feasible to have that from a reliability standpoint? Can you even meet?
I'm not sure. There are a lot of questions on, you know, is it, where can you build it? You know, can you build transmission to it? There are a lot of questions. What are the costs of the transmission? Do EPA consider that the transmission needs to be coincident with the expectation that you would put in all this renewable in a state to create that, let that state meet that target? I'll talk a little bit more about that. There's that, because we'll comment to EPA.
What you're saying is that you've done this work, but we've drawn a line in the sand saying you can't get credit for anything you've done 5 years.
Correct. Yes, we want to be able to have credit for what we have done, right? And so what that number is set at eventually, because I think EPA would then reset that number, depending on comments submitted, we would potentially have a lower target. Maybe that's wishful thinking. I don't know. We're still evaluating. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's all we're about, is making efficiency improvements. You know, that's what we do. We bring those things out. So it's through the course of the life of a power plant, you've been squeezing those things out.
So the answer is 80s and 90s.
Well, how much, if it started at 05, have you gained 1% or 4%? Or
we haven't done that calculation yet ourselves. I think Otter Tail actually has done that, I believe, for Coyote and Big Stone, and they, I think they have slides on that, so that would be good to wait and
okay.
see what theirs are.
And then, you know, just under the current proposal, you say the 6% is unachievable. So if you can exceed the goal in a different building block, do they neutralize, or is their current proposal that you have to meet the goals in each building block separately?
No, EPA just came up with their methodology to show the emissions reductions, but showed the states a way in which they should use those four blocks to gain reductions. It might be that a state chooses to not use one of those building blocks, but they have to make up for it in another building block or another potential that is acceptable to the EPA when state submits its plan.
So going back to this slide, where South Dakota and Minnesota have excess in block three, they can use that to counter some of their shortcomings in one, two, or four.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, but we want to be careful of that because we really think that, there's error. There's an error in that calculation for South Dakota because of the enormity of how it would shut down that unit. And that's not appropriate. The remaining useful life of a unit has to be taken into consideration in 111D.
No, he's looking at the block three where there's excess.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Credits.
Yes, you could use that. I thought you were talking about building block two. Apology. Okay, so now we're at the main issue that Montana Dakota has. And that's with Building Block 2, the redispatch of coal to gas. CPA assumes, again, that combined cycles can be utilized at 70%. With EPA using a 2012 as a base, you would have an overall 30% increase then in the dispatch and combined cycle across the United States because EPA's average... The average dispatch in the combined cycles in 2012 was 40%. So you have this 30% gain in fuel switch or unit switching there.
That average is for your company?
No, national. EPA determined a national average of about 40% capacity factor for combined cycles. We don't have any combined cycles. And you'll hear other companies come up and probably talk about the limitations of that. EPA didn't consider permitting. Like, those units might not even be permitted at their nameplate capacity or have interconnectability to even generate at the nameplate capacity that EPA is assuming can be used to that for that redispatch. A lot of issues. We'll talk about the infeasibility for us with the South Dakota issue. So, again, if no combined cycle in a state, then you don't have any reductions associated with Block 2. And, yeah, South Dakota is our main issue. So
what's the solution in South Dakota? You said the calculation's wrong.
Yeah, I'll talk about it here in the next slide. One thing go ahead.
Is there a fundamental change? When I hear people from MISO talk, I'm always of the understanding that they're required to dispatch the lowest cost power first. And so is EPA calling for, and I assume that that's either something that FERC has implemented or Congress has implemented. So does it take some kind of a federal rule or law that's part of this whole EPA thing? Are we going away from a rule or law that says lowest cost first to policy of lowest
environmental dispatch, where it would be higher cost to run a combined
cycle. Does that take federal legislation?
Well, no, it could be a state assigning, and I'm not suggesting anything here, I'm just expounding on potential way to do this. You could have a megawatt hour limit on a plant. So you can't generate any more than this. Well, we'd have to get that power from somewhere else. And then we'd also have to somehow make sure that our emission target was met, too, that the state might apply to our unit or units. So you'd have to.
But isn't MISO doing the? It's not the. We don't sit up here and dispatch this.
You could. You could put. You would change how your unit was dispatched into the market, and then you get into concerns about potentially withholding generation. So there are some concerns there, and MISO would have to do evaluation of how that would work to determine if there would be reliability issues. We would end up working with MISO to do that. All those evaluations would have to occur before that could be allowed as a target or a emission limit for a unit if it was megawatt hour related. And there are things I'm probably not even thinking about there, so it's pretty complex. Okay, so with South Dakota, there's a target error that has to be corrected. There's one combined cycle Deer Creek Station. It began operation in 2012, and it had a 1% capacity factor in 2012. So that's the capacity that EPA uses to determine how much it can dispatch up to 70%. So 69% of that unit would then dispatch at EPA's assumption in order to back off the generation at Big Stone. And that's what creates this 23% capacity factor for Big Stone. So the issue is that this block creates a huge assumption that that plant will reduce emissions by more than two-thirds. So how does MDU and the co-owners of that plant come up with a way to do that? Because we're not going to be redispatching the unit to Deer Creek Station. We have issues with it being infeasible. We're different owners. We don't have any contractual agreements. We operate in MISO, and they're proposed to be an SPP, different system operators. The Deer Creek's has a unique need for its own customers as well as Big Stone for ourselves. It just isn't possible. So we're going to be commenting on that to EPA.
And the issue here, even though Building Block 2 doesn't affect North Dakota's target, it does affect North Dakota.
Absolutely, because the majority of North Dakota customer or majority of Montana Dakota customers are in North Dakota. And our customers, Big Stone is approximately 28%. Big Stone represents about 28% of Montana Dakota's baseload resource mix. Mm. So that's a significant portion. And I think on the next slide I talk about costs.
Hey, but where was Deer Creek located at?
Near Groton, or I'm near confused.
Near Brookings.
Brookings, okay.
Okay, so it's not that far from Big Stone. So no, Brookings is transmission an issue?
Yes, by the way.
Yeah, it's close physically, but it's not necessarily close on the transmission system.
Okay, so they don't. So they know that.
Different. Different grids and different ways.
Okay, so we need transmission upgrades as well to make
but it
probably.
It's also owned by different
and
owners.
Used for their customers.
Been said Deer Creek is a basin.
I understand that. It's part of the IS.
Yep, and part of that system be part of SPP, or Big Stone's part of MISO. They really aren't in the same world at all. Big Stone has its own customers that plant is, was designed for, and I don't think they're just going to offer up and say, oh, yeah, you can dispatch all of that for your other customers, even if it was physically possible or transactionally possible to do so.
Okay.
There's really no motivation on their side to do it. There's just so many reasons why that just isn't going to work. It fit with EPA's formula of how many megawatts do you have from coal generation and how many megawatts do you have from combined cycle generation. Plug that formula in and here it spits out a number that works fine from that, but in reality it just doesn't work.
This was the first year of operation for Deer Creek, so EPA is using such an extremely low capacity factor and assuming that the majority of that plant's used for MDU. And it just doesn't make sense. And So there are ways in which EPA could potentially recalculate that, although using under construction assumptions with a lower percentage that could be used in that block for potential redispatch. However, we just don't think it's feasible to use that in this case. It really calls into effect, you know, with the reductions required there, the remaining useful life of that unit. We're putting a nearly $400 million, you know, cone total cost, nearly $400 million BART air quality control systems project on that plant, and we're over 50% done with that in costs. It's a huge concern for us. So we don't think Block 2 in South Dakota is feasible.
So the assuming it's a zero-sum game for the overall EPA mandate, if you will, or so South Dakota, if you ask for this, they say, yeah, sure. Then all of a sudden our number is 18% instead of 11. It's got to go somewhere, right? I mean, that I think is a fair assumption. You're not just going to – they're not going to raise the end game. They're going to shift it to a different state.
Well,
so there's got to be some caveats that somehow you nuance that. Otherwise, it'll come to North Dakota.
Yeah, it depends on how they recalculate. If they do any significant
– I'm not arguing with you. I'm just stating a fact here. I mean, it's just – this is the pinch we're in here.
Yeah.
If we wanted something to be blessed change in South Dakota, it's got to go somewhere, unless they're going to change the overall numbers, which I don't think they're going to do. So maybe that's where a recommendation of, if you do this here, we would recommend you do this, whatever that happens to be. Just a thought. That's where, yeah, I'm just very worried about our 11% being 28% when we're done.
Yeah, I understand that too. Yeah. Okay, so like I mentioned, we put together a preliminary cost for replacing Big Stone with a comparable size natural gas combined cycle. The total annual revenue requirement that we just used a year of 2020 for replacing Big Stone is $43.6 million. So the South Dakota Block 2 impact alone yields an approximate 10% increase in rates for our customers. And other co-owners...
What they're already paying for the improvements at Big Stone.
That's above, yep, in addition to the 15% increase for the project and other energy generation resources that we have in our plan, the rates. So ours is about 10%, but it's interesting. The other co-owners at Big Stone have even larger impacts because of their they depend on that resource for even a higher capacity of their baseload needs. So it could be up near 20% rate increase just because of this one block issue.
And this is company-wide. This would be the average impact to your customers, regardless of which of the three states they live
in. Yes.
So then what happens? You come in and ask for it, and we say no. Right? I mean, that's back to the state's rights versus federal rights. That's whatever. You know, everybody puts so much work into this, but it's almost like these guys are ridiculous. They got in a room and threw all this stuff together and said, okay, we'll sort it out. And it's unfortunate, but I've seen federal legislation like that before. And so here everybody's beating their heads trying to make sense out of nonsense. And they just don't get it. So we got to, I guess, be the adults in the room in this thing and keep working this all the way through. But it just does get ridiculous sometimes when we're trying to put sense into this business. Speaking candidly, right?
Yep. Okay. Just wanted to talk about the Block 3 a little bit. Again, EPA groups states into regions based on basically NERC and kind of regional transmission operator region overlap. As shown in this slide, you can see the percentages here assigned to each region are the average RPSs that have been implemented in each of those states, not including the zeros, but the average of those states having RPSs. And then EPA assigns that percentage to every state in its calculation. So state renewable generation then for each state is based on the region percent times the state total generation, which does include the renewables in that state that are generating already. And then you subtract out the renewables that you already or the renewables that you've already implemented, and you come up with this excess number. So like North Dakota, it's 180,000 megawatt hours. There's a lot of generation in the state already, so we're close to that 15% when you get up to 2030.
So additional renewable generation is really total renewable generation. We wouldn't need to increase by 15%. We would need to get to...
Because you take into account renewables that are already in the state to see if you're achieving the 15%. Right. It's just whatever you're missing to achieve that 15% in 2030.
Okay. I just thought of something after my comments before that I should have thought of before, but that's another legal scenario that plays out. The rules come out, MDU does what you're directed to, and then you come back into North Dakota for a rate return, and we say no. Then you appeal the decision to a federal, to a judge somewhere, and then the judge will have to make a decision, and that begins to set precedence of the state's rights versus federal rights. I'm not an attorney, but does that sound reasonable, Stacy? It does, doesn't it? Yeah, but I mean, that's a scenario that will play out, that the commission's, you guys have put in a no-win scenario. You'll have to come back for a rate return based on this. If the commission, state commissions don't give you that, then you have to go back and then appeal that, and the judges will weigh in, which will then will set even more on this, which takes time.
So as I said, for block two is what? Block one is really the only one that isn't beyond the fence. That is the reduction that you can achieve at the source. But block two and block three are beyond the fence, meaning that they're, you know, emissions reductions that you would achieve outside of where you actually have the compliance unit, the affected source. So we see that, again, as a legal issue somebody's going to challenge, as you mentioned. And just a couple other statements. As renewables increase, you know, our capacity factors go down, our heat rates go up, so there's an interconnected issue with block one and block two as well, because if you're redispatching combined cycle, you're going to see that same thing happen to the coal units. And again, just considering with the contradiction and confusion the EPA has in their support documents of who claims what for renewables, we do have a share of our Cedar Hills wind farm that's used for Montana RPS compliance. If renewable RECs go to other states, you know, what does that mean for North Dakota? It means we need to build more renewables here. We have a higher threshold to meet. And then, and I'm not sure, this is more of a question. I apologize to Commissioner Christman because you said you hope for answers, and I still have questions. And do current transmission system upgrades and locations even coincide with the assumptions EPA makes in the renewables deployment? And the cost that they assumed that it would be reasonable to do that. Okay. Block four, this is probably the one that I'm least familiar with, and I might defer any questions to Larry here for us, but I'll attempt this. Okay, so EPA assumes a 1.5% annual energy savings, and this is pretty much applied all across states. And states already having those programs, you know, you can claim those energy savings within those blocks, too. We have to conduct, you know, Dave mentioned, you know, the what do we have to do for evaluation, measurement, and verification, EM and V, to account for these programs. There are states that are already doing this, but there are various ways in which they're doing it, and it needs to be consistent, especially as we have, it'd be more efficient for us to have that be consistent because of multi-state operation and customers. So these are used for compliance. Again, it must be enforceable. There are different ways that can be done. You can make it enforceable at the unit itself to gain, use those credits to gain that. Or state portfolio approach could be used where a state might be held enforceable to make sure those reductions happen. So a lot of work needs to be done for those programs to be used for compliance, legislation, and rules. In North Dakota, I think South Dakota, this applies too, where, you know, we don't, our legislature doesn't even meet every year. So there's another timing piece that I didn't put in that previous slide that needs to be considered. How doable is this with that kind of timing? So again, block four, that's beyond the fence. Potential legal issues. That 1.5% EE target may be achievable, but others think it's pretty aggressive, and especially when you're talking about implementing lower cost programs at first, but those programs down the road might be pretty expensive to gain that last bit of 1.5% efficiency.
What kind of programs would they be? Give me.
And I'm going to let Larry talk about that.
Water heaters, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you'd have to look at what, you know, each utility would look at what portfolio fits their customer base the best. You'd be looking at, you know, refrigerators, freezers, you know, any electric end-use device, you know, that you can get a more efficient model for, lighting, you know, motors, you know, all those types of things would be in a portfolio to achieve that 1.5%.
Are there rate options to encourage customers off-peak and that sort of stuff, or is that not considered?
I think shifting of that usage wouldn't fall underneath this piece. It would be you'd need to conserve or reduce that amount of energy usage or kilowatt-hour usage, so you'd have to focus on technologies that reduce the consumption of electricity.
So in a system like yours that operates in multiple states, and I can't think of an example for you, but if there's an industry in one state that makes it easier for demand reductions than the average of the system, so that industry, you know, something has worked out to cut back, and so it impacts your overall system, then is that savings just for that state, or is it shared over the whole system?
Well, right now it's based on state. So you're saying if we have one customer in one state that's able to curtail their power, and you have a contractual agreement in place that if it, you know, peak power is needed, they'll back off. I think the energy savings from that customer apply to that state with the way, unless
but if it's enough to more than exceed your goal here, can you share it with one of the other states like you were talking about doing with the
renewable
energy?
We would hope that
would
be an option, yes. And that is dependent on how the states will want to work together on that. And again, we talked about the complexities a little bit there of getting that to happen, but that would be desirable for us to have that flexibility. Okay, so, you know, we're concerned about the cost over the period of when we're going to be achieving this. We have a slide that goes into kind of a cost assumption, and we'll talk about that. You may have to have the right policies and legislation in place, make sure that these are enforceable. And EM and V costs could, you know, increase this over time, and I'll have to ask Larry to confirm whether EM and V is in these cost estimates that we're talking about here, but we'll... Okay. So... Okay.
Can you say what EM and V is again?
Evaluation, measurement, and verification, I think.
Yes.
Yep.
Evaluation, measurement, and verification. It's kind of an industry term that they use. That how are you going to measure and verify that those energy savings are real? And there's different methodologies that you can come up to, that they come up with, or protocols on how you would measure the reductions for that individual measure or set of measures.
And before we leave too far, the Block 3 issues, renewable credits to RECs, can you just talk a little bit about that? Because we've kind of just let these things go and let you sell them off. And is there something, should we be looking at what we're doing with RECs for the states? Because we really haven't done much with those at all. And if that becomes a precursor to how the renewables can be assigned, we should look at that again.
Yeah. So when we signed our agreement for wind, our new project, we signed so that we had rights to the environmental attributes of those so we could use them for compliance that way. But yeah, so Montana requires RECs to be surrendered to them. And right now, yeah, we sell RECs the excess RECs.
You come in and ask us, and we say sell them, give money back to the customers.
Yeah, right. We'll have to evaluate whether it's more prudent of us to keep those. Right now, though, with the target that, well, depending on who can claim them, right now they're in the North Dakota target. They're in the state target, so
I think
we'll have to comment on that to make sure that it's clear who gets
what. That's what I was thinking exactly, make it clear that these are our RECs, and they should be but we have to look what we're doing with them, too, if that could say, well, you did all this, so therefore this should go to the other states or whatever.
Yeah.
One more variable, right? Bless you.
Okay. So this graph shows the costs of the first year acquisition of these programs over time. In EPA, we used a ramping formula that is, you know, it's not 1.5% at first, but that's what it ends up being at the end per year. EPA assumes that over the interim period from 2020 to 2029, you know, you're not achieving that 1.5% per year. It's something less than that, but it's reached by about 2029 and then ongoing. So we used first-year acquisition costs to identify what those costs per year would be, although these costs would have to be, would eventually be levelized over time, but this was just the way we approached it, using AC EEE numbers. With this, in 2020, that cost would be approximately $18 per customer per year. We used the lower end of the cost spectrum that AC EEE provided, which this is a 22 cents per kilowatt hour.
Yeah, what we used was AC EEE is the American Council for the Energy Efficient Economy, and they do have a lot of studies regarding energy efficiency and implementation of energy efficiency programs and policy. They did a study that showed some of the states that do a lot of energy efficiency, what is their cost of implementing that energy efficiency? And when you look at energy efficiency, you kind of look at it in two ways. One being that first-year acquisition cost, or what did it cost me to go out and incentivize a customer to put in that higher efficiency unit? And then what is my levelized cost per kilowatt hour over the lifetime of that measure? So that lifetime may be 10 years or 12 years in the case of a refrigerator, or it might be 5 or 6 years in the case of lighting. To levelize that cost over. So we looked at, since we had an annual target of 1.5%, or what that target was each year, we looked at the first-year acquisition costs, which, according to AC EEE and their study that was published in March of this year, the average out there for all of everybody that was included in the study was 22 cents a kilowatt hour of a first-year acquisition cost. So we used that times the percentage savings that we need, or kilowatt hour savings each year, to project these costs out over the horizon in the proposed rule.
Yes. Well,
we put that on there, but it was, if you levelize that over a 10-year period, it would, 22 cents would equal 2.2 cents a kilowatt hour levelized over 10 years. But it's actually the 22 cents is what's used in the calculation.
And that's just the cost of the incentives?
That would include the cost of the incentives, the program administration, the operation, the EM&V, all of that, all inclusive. Works out to about that amount, according to the average. I mean, there's a big range. In the AC EEE study, they show some states are doing it for first-year acquisition costs for maybe, 13 cents a kilowatt hour, all the way up to, 42 cents a kilowatt hour. So there's a big range, but the average is 22.
So the 22, would that be just spread over 1 year's worth of energy savings, or?
Absolutely. That would be your first-year acquisition costs.
And it's good whenever we can do some of these things that cost up. But your point about verification, because I have a whole bunch of friends that bought all these brand new energy efficient fridges, and they put them in their house, and all their old fridges are in their garage for beer. I mean, that's why I've been where I've been on these type of programs, because you can't verify that you're actually doing a thing. So that's just to throw my 2 cents back in there. I'm not against cold beer in the garage either, just for the record.
A lot of challenges. Yeah.
So what is $9 million as you reach those last years? What does that do to your average customer? Is that $5 a month or $2 a month? Or
I didn't run that number on an average customer, but it's probably going to be, you know, in that $30 to $40 annual cost.
Yeah, when I look at what you put together, it's $35. Oh, sorry. Yeah, $18 a year for 2020 using these lower costs. So it about doubles. So yeah, it's about $30 to $40.
Yeah. What? Where's $18 a year?
Per customer.
Per customer.
In 2020, we calculated, you know, on an average residential customer that maybe uses 10,000 kilowatt hours a year. The cost to them would be $18 annual in 2020, based upon that amount of investment that would be made in energy efficiency. And like Abby said, it's about double when you get out to.
Actually, okay. It looks like it's maybe triple that.
Is it triple?
Yeah. I wasn't looking at it.
Yeah. We never ran the number in 2029, but we were trying to estimate what it would be based off what we ran in 2020 numbers.
Okay.
Okay, so we knew that the commission wanted to hear about what we thought, or what, you know, utilities thought of multi-state programs. And our first comment is really the errors need to be fixed in the blocks first. That's key. When you look at, you know, the errors in the blocks, it creates really stringent targets for certain states. So we have a concern with these targets being infeasible, and Dave did talk a little bit about this too, where if you start working with another state with more stringent targets and they don't meet this, what does that mean for the state that didn't have as stringent of a target? What kind of liability concerns do you have? And if you start putting contracts in place or compacts, there might be legal issues that need to be resolved there with interstate compacts. And then, you know, we like the idea of having a fleet-wide compliance approach, which relates to a regional or multi-state coordination. You know, our transmission grid doesn't have any state boundaries. If we could do something that impact, you know, that's fleet-wide, that just decreases costs for our customers.
However, how would we implement something like that? Because just like the transmission grid doesn't have state lines, nor does it have regional lines either. And if we come up with a regional plan that fits MDU's needs, Montana and the Dakotas, that doesn't fit NSP's needs.
Yeah, and that's why we
otter tails.
And, yeah, and that's why we speak so firstly to those blocks have to be fixed so that the targets can be achievable in each individual state.
Yeah, because the regional or multi-state approaches basically, the only solution to that is a federal approach, and I don't think anybody really wants to go there. So the very first part, I think, is where you're right, that we have to have it can be done state by state specifically.
No, but Randy, you keyed up, and I know we need to take a break here, but you keyed up, I think, the down the road where we go out and site a plant right now. MDU comes in and they ask for ADP on something, and we give it to them, and they go build the plant. And then they come to you at some point in time and ask for a permit. We don't even have any role in that whatsoever. If you don't grant their air permit, they can't fire it up. So that the end game of this is that what happens, where at the end of the day, if you don't grant their CO2 permit, they can't build the asset. That's kind of like way down the road in this thing, I think, that how this will play out, just what you said. So anyway.
Okay, I'll quickly sum this up. We have issues with each of the blocks. Block one, the efficiency improvement and feasibility redispatch for block two, renewables, contradictory language, and potential transmission needs. Block four, maybe too aggressive and unenforceable potentially. Timeline's an issue, legal issues for beyond the fence, and can you enforce any of these, especially two through four? Talked about interconnected block issues, making targets more stringent in other blocks. Other options should be available. And we like the fleet-wide approach, but the targets need to be fixed first.
Boom, right, Abby? We're nothing done. To it. Well,
you know, if this were the first I ever heard of this and I just read your summary, I would conclude that this is an unredeemable proposal that's barely even worthy of a response. not yours, but that EPA's is an unredeemable proposal.
I understood.
Proposal. Yeah,
yeah. All right. Well, Abby, I think you and MDU have done a great job setting this up. How does this sound for a plan? I know that 12-1 has got to be a hard deadline for folks. Could we just take a quick break? And then who's up in the queue? Is it Otter Tail or XL? I'm looking at Okay, so if Otter Tail can get, and let's just try to finish the next two investor owns by 12, and we certainly just have to, no, Abby, this has been very good because you laid out the groundwork for everyone, and then when we come in, if the companies could just focus on maybe like the last three slides and differences in what you've said that maybe they don't agree with or they have different twists on it, I think would be okay. Does that sound good to Julie and Randy?
Yep.
All right, let's try to get back here in like 10 minutes. Thank you.
Abby does the